couple that has offered to triple contributions up to $60,000 on that date. Well, you can actually triple your gift right now by going to will.illinois.edu/junejumpstart.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today is Memorial Day, and while it is a day many of us will head to the pool or a cookout, it's also time to honor the men and women in the armed services who have served their country, especially those who gave their lives doing it. So we want to start the program by bringing you the story of Sergeant First Class Melvin Morris. He nearly died while serving courageously in combat in Vietnam. Decades passed before he was fully acknowledged. Sergeant Morris is one of the nearly two dozen veterans who recently received the Medal of Honor, the highest military honor given to someone for an act of valor above and beyond the call of duty. President Obama honored 24 Army veterans with the award last March. All our service members who might have been overlooked or bypassed for the award in the past because of their race or ethnicity. I spoke with Sergeant First Class Melvin Morris earlier this year, just before he was awarded that medal, and he started by telling me about how he found out about the honor.
I received a call in May of last year from Colonel Davis, and he told me that a high government official wants to speak to me, and would I be by the phone the next day at 12:30? And my thoughts was, oh, my God, what have I done? So next day, he called, the phone ring, and I answered Colonel Davis. And he said, the high government officials we can speak to you. And I had no clue. And got on the phone and said, this is President Obama. And I want to apologize to you for the oversight and that you're going to receive the Medal of Honor. And I almost fell on my knees. And he said, wait a minute, be cool, it's okay. And it wasn't much conversation. That was it. I was in shock, I guess.
He could hear you over the phone about to buckle?
Uh-huh. Yes, he could.
Well, fortunately, you didn't fall down.
Yeah, I regained myself. I recovered.
All right. We would have expected nothing less. Do you mind taking us back to the act that brought you this recognition? This was in September of 1969 when you were commanding a strike force in Vietnam when your special forces group came under attack. Do you mind talking a little bit about it? And I do recognize this is not, cocktail party conversation that you just bandy about, but if you could just tell us a little bit about what you remember.
Oh, yeah. Well, we want to... Routine operation when we entered an area, passed through a village, and entered a wood line. And that's when the firefight started. And my team sergeant was killed almost immediately. And they called on the radio and said my team sergeant was KIA. And my captain said he was wounded 3 times. And I started to move forward, and then I found out that the senior NCO, he was also wounded. I stepped on a mine, I think. And then I had to go into action because there was only 2 people left. And that was me and my assistant. Mm-hmm. So I moved forward, and I knew I had to recover his body because we don't leave no soldier behind. Irregardless, it was... A lot of weapons fire. So I moved forward and I organized my troops, and we laid down a suppressive base of fire so I could get to the body. And I got to the body and I gave him last rites. And as soon as I finished, they opened fire on me. And I ran back out. Then I decided to get 2 volunteers to go back in. And I went back in with them to recover his body, and they got wounded. So I took them out, and I got 2 more to go back in with me. And then we recovered the body, even though we had intense gunfire. And while we were taking his body out, the map case fell out of his pocket. And I had to go back again, so I decided to go by myself. But my interpreter volunteered to go with me. And when we got in, one of the enemy faced me, and my interpreter couldn't shoot, so he shot me in the chest. Mm. And I went down, my interpreter got out, and I'm left now by myself. So they were trying to take me out. And I decided I had to fight for my life. And in the process, I got wounded again in my right arm. I'm already wounded in my right chest. And I continued to fight, and I got wounded in my left ring finger. I got shot in my left ring finger. Hmm. So I'm in Dire Straits at that time. So the Navy came over with a small helicopter, and they said they could drop explosives to help me out, to get out. And they did that, and it helped some. And I felt like the only way I could get out is I had to fight out. And I used all the ammunition I had to suppress the fire. Hmm. And I run out, zigzag, and they were trying to get me, but I made it out, and I was able to catch my company because I told them not to come back and get me if I went down, just to move back to the rear. And just luckily enough that I could still catch them, and they made a stretcher, put me on a stretcher, and called in a medevac, and they medevaced me out.
And you made it out despite being shot three times, having retrieved a map, that had strategic information, and recovering the body of your comrade. Do you have any way to describe what it is that allowed you to keep going?
Duty and mission is some unsung rules. You have to do what you have to do. I couldn't leave the body, and I knew I couldn't leave sensitive information. So even though it was a great risk to me, this is something I had to do.
If you're just joining us, this is an encore broadcast of my interview with the Medal of Honor recipient, Sergeant First Class Melvin Morris. We spoke with him earlier this year, just before he was honored by President Obama. You were previously awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, but this award comes about because the Congress decided some years ago to ask for a review of awards, military awards, to see if there are people who had been left out or who should have been seen in a kind of a different light. And it turns out that there are some, I mean, lawmakers were specifically looking for people of Jewish descent and people of Hispanic background. And I think, you know, African-Americans were kind of subsequently added to that review. Forgive me, because I don't think this is kind of your thought process here, but I did want to ask if you ever felt, or anyone in your family ever felt, that you had been overlooked.
No, because, you know, I was a Green Beret, and we didn't worry about stuff like that, you know. And I felt like when I was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, you know, that's what it was. And I never really questioned whether I should get the Medal of Honor or not. I never considered it until now.
What about that now? Do you have any mixed feelings about it, or does it just feel like pure joy, pure appreciation?
It's my appreciation, and what I'm proud about is that they are correcting the oversights. And I hope they continue. I mean, you know, they realize now that there's a possibility of oversights, and that they're taking care of it now, and I feel great about that.
You served at a time when people who wore the uniform were not always appreciated when they returned home, and I wondered, what were your experiences when you came back to the States after your military service?
A lot of apprehension, because we already knew of the stories of what's happening at the airports and back home. And I think I only ran into one incident in Chicago O'Hare. I didn't feel good about it, because I felt like we were doing what we had to do, and that's protect this country, our country. And it bothered me for a while because I couldn't really understand. They demonstrated this colony of baby killers and stuff like that.
That must have been difficult.
It was. It was. Mm.
What was the rest of your life after the service?
After the service, I tried. It was difficult, I'll be honest. And, you know, I had a hard time adjusting. And I just sought the right help to get me on the right track. And the greatest thing I ever did, and I encourage any soldier that has problems after combat, seek the help. I did, and it saved my life.
Hmm. I'm glad to hear that. Of the 24 honorees, you are one of the three who are still able to receive the award directly from the president. There are only three who are still now living. And I wondered, just if you feel comfortable speaking on behalf of all of them, is there something that you would wish the rest of us to know about your service that perhaps we don't know?
Well, one comment. I really think about the ones that gave their life. And going back to my team sergeant, he gave his life, and he gave the ultimate sacrifice. That's my real hero. And all the ones that gave their lives, they are not here to accept a decoration or an honor. They gave it all. And I often dwell on that. And I'm glad I'm receiving this honor in honor of them.
Do you feel appreciated now?
I feel like a weight has been lifted. Yes, I do.
That was Medal of Honor recipient Sergeant First Class Melvin Morris. Coming up, when he was first elected to Congress in 2006, Representative Keith Ellison drew more headlines and attracted more heat than usual as the first Muslim elected to Congress. But he says that his faith is just one part of him.
I talk about it when I'm asked about it. That's pretty much my rule.
He talks about religion, patriotism, and his memoir, My Country, Tis of Thee, My Faith, My Family, Our Future. That conversation is just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Suddenly, from behind the clouds,
director John Ford shot footage of the Battle of Midway during World War II. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mark Harris, author of Five Came Back, about five celebrated Hollywood directors who volunteered for service to chronicle World War II. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We are continuing our special coverage for Memorial Day with Encore Conversations, and we talk now about the sacrifices that military families make. Military service these days can come with long and repeated deployments and frequent moves, not to mention the emotional toll of sending a spouse or parent into dangerous conflicts. Now, lots of people and groups want to be helpful. According to the National Military Family Association, there are thousands of websites designed to help members of the military and their loved ones find resources like housing, counseling, and education. But the sheer amount of information out there can be daunting. So the NMFA is out with a smartphone app called My Military Life that they hope will help. I recently spoke with Michelle Joyner. She is the communications director for the NMFA, and Laura Yates, a military spouse in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, who volunteers for the organization. And I began by asking Michelle Joyner what challenges the app was designed to address.
In the 12 years that this war has been going on, we've seen great community swell of support for military families. But when you do a quick Google search, you could get 10,000 results. And that type of information is paralyzing. And so where do you go? Who do you trust? What do you know what's best for you? We've been in this area supporting military families for over 40 years. And we used to answer these questions by phone, and then they became by email. And so it was like, well, now how can we scale this? And we need an app, because people are wondering about, my husband's back from deployment, but my kids don't know him. My kids don't want to go to him. Is that normal? Is our relationship normal? Are these the things I should be experiencing? And so having a resource or a tool that lets you know what you should expect, what questions you should be asking, and where to go for help is what military families need.
And part is what you're doing, curating the information to be sure that it's valid?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've been doing for 45 years. And we want to make sure that military families are using legitimate resources for them and that they are not falling through the cracks, that they're being plugged into the support services that were designed to protect them. And so we're taking in that information, we're evaluating where it's coming from, and making sure that folks are staying away from the scammers. That's one thing that we definitely know affects our community.
Laura Yates, let's turn to you now. Your husband is a master sergeant in the 104th Airborne Division of the Army, so I want to thank him through you for his service. And I also want to thank you because you are also serving, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
It does take the whole family to support these service members. Can you give us an example? I understand that you aren't sure that this is exactly the target audience for this, because you kind of have some miles on, right, in this service. But who do you think would benefit from this kind of thing?
Well, I think it would benefit all spouses, both new spouses and more seasoned spouses. From the new spouse perspective, I know when I married my husband, I was coming into a world that I really didn't understand. I didn't understand the rank structure of the Army per se. I didn't understand what services were available to me. So one good thing about the application, they have a section that's geared for new spouses. So you can go on there and learn about, oh, what do these acronyms mean? And what are the different ranks? And then you can learn about resources that are available on your post, like classes for new spouses, orientation classes. I mean, I know a lot of those new spouses don't know that. But also, more seasoned spouse like me, there is information that's relevant on there for me. My husband's actually going through a medical board to be transitioned out of the Army, and mm-hmm. there's a section on transition. That's not an area that I'm familiar with. There's information about caregiver support. You know, I may have to support him in the future because of his condition, and so there's information about services available through the VA, and then also information about how to take care of myself as a caregiver mm-hmm. as I support him.
Let me co-sign that. You do need to take care of yourself, so we hope you will do that. What about that, Michelle? Is there taking care of yourself, the caregivers being taken care of themselves? Is that part of the service, part of the app?
Absolutely. Caring for the caregiver is definitely an area that we focus on, because we know that military families are oftentimes those people who are put in the caregiver role. We also recognize that military families are going to go through so many different events in their lifestyle. And so when you join, you need information on one thing. But then when you have kids, or when you move, or when you're experiencing a deployment, those all introduce new challenges to the military.
How do you, Michelle, how do you assure yourself that the resources that you're identifying are in fact valid? Because I actually did a little test myself on
sure.
to see where what comes up when I looked up a specific program. And I saw literally, I saw like 10 different sites. And I think some of them were steering toward, you know, outdated forms and things of that sort. And I could see where that would be quite intimidating. You know, even for somebody like myself, I'm trained to look up information. I still found it kind of scary and overwhelming. So how do you assure yourself and the people who are using the app that the information is current, up to date, valid, and so forth?
Absolutely. And that's a great question and a concern for us. One of the first things that we go to are definitely the resources that the military provides that are paid for by tax dollars and that we know are targeted to military families. If it's a nonprofit, we're looking at their charity ratings. We're looking to make sure that businesses are, you know, better business examples. We want to make sure that folks who we recommend have the capacity to serve serve military families, that there's a lot of goodwill out there, but oftentimes it's hard to identify with somebody if they don't understand your lifestyle.
Well, in the couple of minutes that I have left, can I just ask you more broadly, what are some of the other things that would support, Laura, that would support you? Tell me some things that people, particularly who aren't sharing your burden, can do to help share that burden.
I think that there needs to be more support groups for soldiers and families going through medical transition. I think the Army has a great hold on the transition process from what I've seen. But as far as going through medical transition, that's one thing I haven't really found, were as many support groups or support sources for those going through a medical transition.
Mm. Michelle, what about you? More broadly, what are some of the other things? I mean, I think it's important to remember we live in a time when a lot of people have no experience with military service anymore. So could you just take this opportunity to tell, you know, everybody else, like, what are some of the things that you think would be helpful if
Absolutely.
You want to support these families?
Sure thing. Mental health counseling is one of the top items on our list. The nation at a whole is short mental health providers, but definitely those that understand military families and the struggles that they face. We need more recognition in communities of who our military families are. Most military families live outside of a traditional brick-and-mortar military installation, and so knowing the kids in your school who are military-connected, or the kids on your soccer team, or the military spouses that you employ are very, very important, and offer those families some flexibility.
That was Michelle Joyner, Communications Director for the National Military Family Association here in our Washington, D.C. studios, and Laura Yates, a military spouse, joined us from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Now we turn to Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. On this program, we often talk about the intersection of faith and politics. My next guest is a trailblazer in both of those areas. When he was first elected to Congress in 2006, Keith Ellison was the first Muslim elected to the U.S. Congress, as well as the first person of color elected to represent Minnesota in the national legislature. Along the way, he's had to confront questions about his faith and patriotism, as well as some unpaid parking tickets that nearly derailed his first campaign. He talks about all of that in his book, My Country, 'Tis of Thee, My Faith, My Family, Our Future. When we sat down earlier this year, I began our conversation by asking him why he decided to write the book.
I'll say that the fact that led to the invitation to write the book was when I was a witness at a hearing at the Homeland Security Committee. Chairman Peter King convened the hearing, and the focus was violent radicalization among American Muslims, and he had a bunch of other hearings that he did on violent radicalization among Muslims in prison, violent radicalization among Somali Muslims. And I went to him and I said, you know, you could stereotype a community and do a lot of damage if you do it this way. What if you just did violent radicalization and included a range of people who might present a national security threat to Americans? And of course, you would include some people who are Muslim in that. He said, nope, we're not doing that. And then he and I went back and forth, but he said, look, here's what I'll do. I'll let you testify. So I did testify. And in the course of my testimony, which started out very calm, cool, and rational, I started talking about a kid named Mohammed Salman Hamdani.
I have a clip if you would like to hear it. Why don't
Go
we play
for
a short clip? Here it is.
Some people spread false rumors and speculated that he was in league with the attackers because he was a Muslim. But it was only when his remains were identified that these lies were exposed. Mohammed Salman Hamdani was a fellow American who gave his life for other Americans. His life should not be identified as just a member of an ethnic group or just a member of a religion, but as an American who gave everything for his fellow Americans.
For those who don't remember, that you were focusing on this young man who died while rescuing others from the World Trade Center. Do you remember what sparked that?
You know, when you played that clip, it sent chills right back mm-hmm. through me, like I was sitting at that table. And, you know, it was started out very calm. I was fine. But as I just started thinking about that boy, his mother, so many people I've known who've been yanked off airplanes, had their hijabs pulled off their head, been stabbed, been had their mosque defaced, and been opposed by zoning commissions. I don't know. Maybe it was just all that that came together in my mind at that moment. I don't know. I got to tell you, I don't know what came over me. And I remember when I was done feeling embarrassed and wanting to get out of there. That's what I remember. Mm-hmm. But anyway, after that, Simon & Schuster called me. A woman named Karen Hunter, who's since then become a great friend of mine, said, look, you should write a book. But even that doesn't explain why I said yes to that, right? I said yes because I just think that our country is at a new crossroads in terms of inclusion. We have a new scapegoat, and we need to address it as we have addressed others in the past. And so that's why I decided to write the book.
And it pulls together, you know, a lot of kind of the strands of your life, including the fact that you grew up in a family that was pretty agnostic. I mean, your dad, yeah, in particular,
yeah,
you mentioned, who's had a kind of a hard scrabble road to eventual professional success as a doctor. Not terribly religious.
No.
Not terribly in love with organized religion anyway.
Right, true.
And you write actually very beautifully about your introduction to the Quran and how it appealed to you, which is interesting because people who hear you speak as a politician don't often hear that poetry in your voice. And I just wondered if you could try to capture a little bit of what
the moment of
when you realized that this was your destiny.
I don't know if it's possible, but all I can remember is that listening to the preacher talk about how the mission of Muhammad, you know, the prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, was justice, and that he confronted the status quo in Mecca where he lived and grew up, and that what he was really seeking is freedom, and he stood up with Bilal, who had been an enslaved person, and Bilal nearly died professing his faith in the one God, and that I found this incredibly moving and unifying and inclusive, and that this was a group of people from diverse backgrounds united in the idea that they would submit to none but the creator of the heavens and the earth.
You know, you do tell this funny story. Well, actually, it's funny to me because I didn't have to live through it, where some unpaid parking tickets that you had accumulated while you were in... I'm sure you're glad I brought that up, right?
No, I mean,
that
it happened.
Accumulated while you were in private practice and then in the legislature running around, surfaced... And it really had a significant effect on your primary race. In fact, you know, your poll numbers were dropping at that time because of that. I mean, so I'm trying to think between unpaid parking tickets and being a Muslim, which was the bigger issue for you?
Well, at the moment in that primary, it was the unpaid parking tickets for sure. And because, you know, Minnesota has this tradition of being liberal and inclusive, and it is that. But they're also very good government people, and they don't take kindly to folks not following the rules, particularly when they follow them. So the best advice I got is from a former governor who said, Keith, you simply must apologize because
nobody wants to hear you were too busy.
Nobody wants to hear it because, like, we're all busy. And it was an important lesson in my life.
You know, one of the first big decisions you made was to take the oath of office on the Quran, and you took it on a Quran that Thomas Jefferson had owned. I'm interested in your decision-making on this because I know it came up during the campaign because somebody said to you, well, if you win, and this is even before you'd won, if you win, will you take the oath on the Quran? And you said you hadn't even really thought about it. I was interested in how you did come to a decision and what is your overall philosophy of when you'll talk about your faith and when you won't?
Well, you know, I came to the decision to swear in on the Quran because it did not occur to me that it would be a problem. You know, maybe, I mean, I don't know what that reflects about me, but I just, when I was asked the question, my primary concern was getting voters out to the polls, not what I was going to swear in on. I hadn't even assumed that I would be swearing in on anything because the election had not come. And so I said, well, yeah, sure. Why? Of course, I'll sign and swear in on the Quran, because it occurs to me that if your elected official is one who would want to swear in on a holy book, you'd want them to swear in on the holy book that they profess to. Right. Because that's what makes the oath solemn. You know, what role does faith play in my life? And when do I talk about it? I talk about it when I'm asked about it. That's pretty much my rule. I believe that faith is important to Americans. But I also believe very firmly in that constitutional amendment, which says Congress shall make no law establishing religion or abridging the free exercise thereof. So it's important in American life. I feel that it's absolutely inappropriate to impose my faith on anyone. But when people want to discuss matters of faith, I find myself willing to do that.
What message would you want people to draw from this book? And we're really only scratching the surface of some of the very interesting stories that you tell, including how you revealed your new faith commitment at Thanksgiving dinner, which I don't think is something you advise, right? To our other families who are embracing. But what would you want people to draw from the book?
I think the idea of My Country, 'Tis of Thee is that we are gifted with an amazingly diverse, wonderful country that holds as its highest aspirations inclusion. And yet the fact of our lives is that we're not always that way. Yet we should always be on the path to be making America a more perfect union. And that means no matter what culture or faith group you come from, that we all should be on the path toward making this a country where we can all sincerely sing with no reservations, My Country, 'Tis of Thee, Sweet Land of Liberty.
That was Congressman Keith Ellison. His latest book is My Country, 'Tis of Thee, My Faith, My Family, Our Future. Coming up, singer-songwriter Liv Warfield has brought down the house on two different late-night talk shows. She says her powerhouse presence on stage isn't just for show.
I just kind of really want to put myself into my songs. I just want to feel every lyric.
Liv Warfield joins us for a special in-studio performance and conversation. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, combining conventional and integrative therapies to help maintain quality of life during treatment at cancercenter.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices, waltonk12.org. And from Inada, crafting shiatsu massage chairs for over 50 years, and makers of the DreamWave Total Body Massage Chair at dreamwavechair.com. This is NPR.
I'm Marco Werman. The whole world is talking.
The people on the ground are saying they know the forest and they will go and get the girls.
Assuming that we are able to assist the Nigerians in bringing the girls home safely, the threat of Boko Haram will still exist.
Boko Haram are getting bolder. They're trying to tell people that wherever you are, we are right next to you, but you can't see us.
Join us and hear the world.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, with instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, 50+, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start the first week of June. Details at yoga-cu.com or 344-YOGA.
Coming to WILL-TV, the My Music series presents its first big band music retrospective featuring the biggest songs that got us through World War II and kickstarted the baby boom. Hosted by Peter Marshall, this nostalgic program brings you a mix of live, rare, and unreleased footage featuring the original hitmakers and brassy legends from the big band days. Watch The Big Band Years, Saturday night at 6 on WILL-TV.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Don't we all know people who walk around like they own the room? Nobody's shocked when their names show up in lights. And then there's the superstar who's unexpected.
You think that was good? You ain't seen nothing yet. Like a bee to some honey. Mom to play. You got an addiction and you got me to play. You never saw it coming. I made no claim until now. Call it the unexpected, you can call it.
That was the title cut, The Unexpected, from singer-songwriter Liv Warfield's latest album. With an edgy, eclectic, and soulful sound, she's been described as the new face of R&B. That fresh take has earned her the support of legends like Prince, who wrote the title track, and late-night host Jimmy Fallon, who gave her her first national TV debut. So how excited are we that Liv Warfield was able to stop by NPR's Performance Studio One to chat and share some songs from the latest album? She sat down with me recently, and I began by asking her how she started singing.
You know, it was hiding away from the parents, closing the door when they left. I got it in. I sang a lot of Whitney songs. I kind of kept it inside. I knew I could sing when I was about 7 years old, but since athletics was in very much the forefront of my life and I was kind of doing that a lot, I don't think anybody was caring or looking for me to be singing anything. So, yeah, I just kept it hidden from everyone.
Why though? Why do you think you did?
I don't think anybody was checking for an athlete to be singing anytime soon. I was shy.
What do you think finally made you let it out?
When I got away from home and I got away from people's opinions or people's thoughts of what I should be, I kind of knew for myself what I wanted to do. But when I moved away from home, 2,000 miles away, I got some strength to kind of like do what I wanted to do, you know, and sing. And that kind of started in the karaoke bars. And
really?
Yeah,
karaoke?
It did.
A good reason to go. You don't know, there might be a diamond in the rough in there, huh?
Hey. it's funny because I really, really took it serious. And that was kind of like, actually my teammate, I actually got a track scholarship at Portland State University. And my teammate was like, they have these bars where you can go and sing. And I was like, are you kidding me? What? Seriously? And that just opened up a door for me. And then on in Portland really embraced me and kind of brought me up singing.
You know, to that end, you just killed this performance on Jimmy Fallon's late night show earlier this
Thank
year
you.
To the point where he almost like fell on the floor.
Oh.
He goes, that's how you do it. That's how you do it.
And
then,
so
then,
the, cool.
then that clip got passed around and I was reading some of the comments. I don't know if you do. One of them was, used to run track with her in high school, and she had all this voice. Who knew? Do that, Olivia.
That's crazy.
One of your, yes.
Wow.
Did you know that some of your fans were back in the day were following you?
I didn't.
So track was supposed to be your thing, right?
Yeah,
that was your thing.
I really wanted to go to the Olympics. Like, that was my goal. I really wanted to go to the Olympics, but that changed, and your life kind of turns and kind of went with it, so...
As I mentioned, the title track, The Unexpected, was written by Prince. How did you end up meeting him, and how has he influenced your sound, your work?
Well, I met him, actually. There's a friend of mine that said at the time, I think about, five years ago, Prince was looking for a singer. And I had a couple of clips on YouTube of me singing, like, Gimme Shelter. And he was like, you should send it. You should send the YouTube clip. And I'm like, are you crazy? I'm not going to send that. He's not going to, like... I'm never going to get a call, but whatever. So we sent it in. You know, I didn't know that he did. 3 or 4 months later, I get a call to come to Paisley. That totally changed my world. I tell people, I remember the first day when I walked into Paisley, I kind of refer to like Spike Lee. I'm just kind of like sitting there and everything is moving. The hallway, everything is moving. I'm just kind of like, I'm not touching anything. I don't want to, but he was really, really welcome and welcoming. And Prince has just really, really taught me.
And warm. You were saying how warm he is.
Yes.
Forgive me, but this is, I think this will be a surprise to many people who are used to seeing him as anything but. How do you think he's influenced you? You've mentioned on a couple of occasions that he's influenced both your in-studio performance and your stage performance.
Mm-hmm. He's influenced me first and foremost, I can think of as a performer. Just kind of like taking chances first. And even in the writing and arranging and him just teaching me how to really listen to the music. You know, he developed my ear. He really did. So
let's hear something. Let's see. I think the first song you would like to sing for us is Blackbird. And I'm told that your accompanying guitar player wrote it. Is this true?
Yes.
And so why don't you introduce him and he or you can, in the spirit of sharing.
Yes, absolutely.
He can tell us about it.
This is the amazing, wonderful Ryan Waters. And he's an amazing, amazing, amazing guitar player.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, tell us about it.
Boy, how do I even
Well, what were you thinking about when you wrote it?
Yeah, it started by just kind of observing a blackbird while walking down the street, and immediately, being a musician, the first thing that comes to mind is the Beatles song. You kind of just start singing that in your head. And looking at this struggling bird just kind of getting through his day, scratching and kicking to survive, I thought what McCartney was writing about had nothing to do with this bird's experience. So that sort of gave me a starting place, and Paul McCartney got it wrong. That was
okay.
That's really how it started.
That's another title too.
Paul McCartney
got it wrong. I like it.
And that's the first lyric of the song, and that sort of opened up a whole story for me, and I just took it from there. And and then Liv brought it to life, and which you're about to hear now.
All right, let's hear it. All right. This is Blackbird. This is from Liv Warfield's latest album, The Unexpected. Like the man said, do that, Olivia. And Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you've come out of your shell.
Yes.
A little bit.
I have.
A little bit. Well, you have quite an imposing in person. I could see why you say that you're shy. I would not have guessed that from your onstage persona, right? Because
yeah.
You're quite, you know, commanding. You're tall.
Uh-huh.
You have an amazing look.
Thank you.
And I just wondered, does it divide up that way? Are you kind of a different person on stage?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a certain kind of freedom for me when I get on stage. Maybe it's because I've held it back for so long that it's maybe a little bit of angst inside. It's kind of like this energy needs to come out. And there's a certain sense, you know, of freedom when I get on that stage.
Is there some anger too?
Yeah.
Is there a little bit of anger?
Yeah,
I mean, that
bit.
Performance of Why Do You Lie, which we're not going to do here because it requires a lot of horns.
Yes.
A lot of horns. But in a way, it's kind of you like letting people know what is up
yeah.
and will not be tolerated. And I just wonder, is there a little anger there?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I just kind of really want to put myself into my songs. Lyrically, I just want to feel every lyric. Maybe it comes across a little angry, brash at times, but that, you know, it's in a good way. I think I just want to display that emotion in the music.
So what's fueling you now as an artist?
I really think I found me finally in the music. you know, I had put an album out before, Embrace Me, and it's been 7 years since that. So I was discovering who I was, and I still am discovering, but I think now I know a little bit more of who I am. So that's what's pushing me. I'm like, okay, what else? What else do you want to do? You know, working with Prince, it's kind of like he's opened up this whole new world, especially with the horn players. And I'm like, man, only if I had strings on this album too. And I'm like, I wish I had an orchestra. So I just, you know, I just wonder what's next. You know, I want to constantly push myself for more.
Well, we want more too.
Yeah.
So I think.
Thank you.
I think you're also going to give us one more. I think it's called Catch Me If You Can. You want to tell us about what inspired this one?
Well, I like to watch some old blaxploitation movies, and my favorite is Cleopatra Jones. And I was very inspired by the chase scene. I love muscle cars, and I was at home on the table, and I think my husband was cooking or something, and I was beating on the table or whatever, and I was like, okay, I need to press record now, start singing these vocals, because it just came, you know, that's how the songs come, it just came, and I'm like, boom, catch me if you can, which I'm not going to ruin it now, but, and then I sent it to Ryan, and I'm like, Ryan, what do you think would be cool over this? And then Ryan sent this cool guitar riff, which you will hear, and just... it birthed this amazing, amazing song, so I love it.
All right, let's hear it. Catch Me If You Can.
Catch me if you can, I'm out of here. We in love, please don't stop us now, we out of here, oh. Gonna do save the world, honey. Let's get them parachutes gone. Got $30 to our names. We'll survive. Mama taught me well. I won't complain. No, no. Loving you just comes so. My past lovers moving on. Got somebody who can stand the rain. Oh, 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 oh. Catch me if you can. I'm out of here. We in love, please don't stop us now. We out of here. Catch me if you can. I'm out of here. We in love, please don't stop us now. We out of here. Catch me if you can. I'm out of here.
Well, thank you. That was fun. I hope you don't mind my mentioning, this is not the easy road to getting here. That you,
no.
It was not. I mean, there were points at which you were living out of your car.
Absolutely.
Is that okay for me to say?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's a reality, you know, and I'm super thankful, but it was always those things that I sacrificed that kind of kept me going, because I knew there was something else if I just never gave up on it. You know, of course, there were times I wanted to.
Why do you think you didn't?
It's just the inside voice that tells you not to, the spirit that tells you not to, that you have something to give. You have more lyrics to write. You have more songs to write with amazing musicians and artists and stuff. So I think it keeps me going. It does.
Do you mind if I ask, coming from such a strict background, where you weren't even supposed to listen to secular music, let alone perform it. How is your family with what you're doing now? Have they made peace with it?
Oh, yeah. Before? before, I'm not going to bust her out, but it was really hard for her to take.
You mean your mom?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. She wanted to come to Portland and snatch me up so bad. I was like, you, what? you're not going to class. But now they understand it. They understood how serious I was about it. They didn't come to my first show till I moved out to Portland. And they were like, what's going on? Like, are you really even doing this? And it took her a while, but she loves it. I mean, she's excited about it, very excited about it. So
that's great.
They're very, very supportive. I mean, very supportive. And I'm so thankful that they're in my corner like that. So,
well, that's great.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for bringing Mr. Ryan.
Yes, thank you.
Liz Warfield is a singer and songwriter. Her latest album, The Unexpected, is available now. And she was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Liz Warfield, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. It's fun.
We are sure you want to hear a little more music, so before we go, here is Soul Lifted from Liv Warfield's album, The Unexpected. And that's our program for today. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'd like to say thank you to the millions of Americans whose loved ones made the ultimate sacrifice. Let's talk more tomorrow.
My soul has been lifted to a higher place.